This is the Stella Culinary School Podcast, Episode 5, Basic Starches. This is the Stella Culinary School Podcast, found online at stellaculinary.com. My name is Jacob. Thank you once again for joining me. And hey, if you haven't already, check out our Stella Culinary Facebook fan page. It's kind of cool. The nice thing about it is I can update it mobily through my phone. So, you know, if you ask me a question through Facebook, especially through the fan page, I can, you know, so whip out my iPhone and take a photo or a video or something and post it. But also the way that they allow you to do the photo albums is nice. And so because our menu changes so consistently on a week-to-week basis and definitely on a month-to-month seasonal basis, I've been grouping the photo albums month by month. So it's kind of cool to go back and look at, you know, at least for me it is, to go back and look at the food that we did in, you know, say November and December and January. And I think it's a lot of fun. And also we've so we can keep better track and chronicalize, if that's even a word. Here I go just making up words again. The dishes that we're taking and the different menus, not only to so we can remember them, but also a lot of what we serve at Stella becomes recipes for our website, and it's nice to always have photos that go along with that. So we've been setting up a photo booth with a nice, you know, a couple of nice little photo lights in the back with, you know, white tablecloth. So the photos, I think, for, you know, what we're doing and the technology that we're using, which isn't super advanced, but they're coming out pretty nice. And so it's kind of fun to check them out. So if you haven't already, and you can always be my Facebook friend too, if you just search for Jacob Burton or, you know, Truckee Stella, whatever. But, you know, check out the Stella Culinary fan page and you'll be able to, you know, do a friend request from there. So that's it. Today we're going to be talking about starches and three starches in specific. And the reason why I kind of constructed this podcast the way it is for this episode is the fact that we're starting to get into the territory of doing a completed dish, right? Last episode, in episode 4, we talked about how to properly blanch your vegetables, how to, blanch the root vegetables and your greens. And those are normally going to be served as a side dish, right? As part of a completed main course or a completed entree. So in this episode, we're going to talk about risotto, polenta, and mashed potatoes. Because if you can master these three starches, there's so many different variations that you can do with each one of these starches, either by serving it as a main course in itself or as playing a supporting role on a main course dish or an entree dish, then you're going to open up a lot of nice avenues. And plus, you really need to understand how to make polenta, risotto, and mashed potatoes because they're very basic. So even if you've made it before, we're going to, you know, talk about a little bit more, a few in-depth techniques and tricks and, you know, how I go about making it. And then you can sort of figure out between the methods that I use and the methods that you already know what really works best for you. But bottom line, you should have to master these. I mean, it's just, you know, you really should be able to master these three simple starches. Now, you heard me talk about, you know, putting together an entree or a main course. Now, there are some differences, right, between as far as depending upon where you live in the world, the meaning of an entree and the meaning of a main course. So we're going to go over that in our discussion segment before we even get into the technique on how to make the starches. All All right, so in today's discussion segment, we're going to touch real quick on just the terminology of what a main course is and what an entree is. And the terminology does change depending upon, you know, where you are, where you live, what you do. So, for example, in Europe, right, an entree means entry, or it's basically the course that precedes the main course. However, in North America, the usage is different, right? See, after the disappearance in the early 20th century of the large communal dish, such as a roast, you know, it used to be that we would just, you know, roast a nice leg of lamb or a big piece of meat, and you'd put it in the center of the table, and everyone would just, it'd be a communal dish that everyone would pick off of, right? But when that sort of disappeared, we started to do our plated main courses, right? Individually plated main courses. And for whatever reason, in the United States, we refer to these as entree, right? And that's what we use to describe something as the main course itself. And so typically when you talk about an entree in the United States, you're talking about, you know, anywhere from 6 to 8 ounces of protein, 3 to 4 ounces of starches, and 3 to 4 ounces of vegetables. And that's your basic rounded out main course that usually is preceded by, you know, a salad, and sometimes every now and then is finished with a small dessert. So the fact that we're touching on these starches today is kind of here to lay the foundation for you to do a completed dish with a starch, a vegetable, and a protein. So after the starch episode, we're going to get into a 4 or 5 episode series on basic hot side cooking techniques, where we talk about how to, you know, saute, roast, you know, roti or pan roast, confit, braise, all that good stuff. And that's going to be the final component to your plated dish, right? Your protein. And so we're going to talk more in depth in that. But it is kind of funny too, you know, that's how we have these different little words that mean different courses, because we eat so much dang food, we got to, like, you know, give each course a name, right? So what other people would call an entree, we would call our first course in the United States, right? Our appetizer or our starter. Now, sometimes the word hors d'oeuvre is used interchangeably with the starter or the appetizer, but really an hors d'oeuvre is something small that is commonly served before the first course, like a bowl of olives. So an hors d'oeuvre is the course you eat before, the course you eat before your main course. And if you never heard before, Jim Gaffigan has a great bit on this. It's off of his album, The Last Supper. I'm going to lead into our technique segment with this little bit that he does. But if you've never listened to him, or if you don't own a CD, if you're into food, I mean, this guy is so obsessed and talks so much about food. Head on over to stellacolony.com. In episode 5's show notes, I'll have a link to his site, or you can go there directly as jimgaffigan.com, and I highly recommend his CD, The Last Supper.
Whenever you go out, you got to get the appetizer, because the appetizer is just an excuse for an extra meal. And I was like, let's see, I will start with the 80 buffalo wings. And do you have a low-cal blue cheese? Because I don't want to fill up too much. It would be kind of embarrassing trying to explain what an appetizer is to someone from a starving country, though. Yeah, the appetizer, that's food we eat before we have our food. Yeah. No, you're thinking of dessert. That's food we eat after we have our food. Yep, we eat tons of food. Sometimes there's so much, we just stick it in a bag, bring it home. Give it to the dog. You ever get the doggy bag? You're like, oh no, put this in a box in a bag and I'll bring it home and throw it out tomorrow. That is so true. He speaks the truth.
So in today's discussion segment, we're going to talk about the starches that I alluded to before, which are mashed potatoes, polenta, and risotto. And these are, again, if you can knock these out of the park every single time, you're going to have a lot of different things that you can do with them before you even have to start worrying about, you know, getting into, you know, other more advanced starches. Now, I do understand that this is, look, these aren't the only 3 starches in the world, obviously. I'm just trying to give you guys something to go off of, okay? I could very easily add pasta in here, but pasta is so complex, and there's so many different ways to do it unto itself. I mean, that's going to require a whole episode, maybe just a couple episodes, just on pasta. Because, again, it's such a world unto itself. So this is just a starting point that you can grab and run with. So let's first talk about risotto. And I love risotto. Now, if you haven't had risotto before, it's basically a creamy rice dish that hails from Italy. And but when I say creamy, that does not mean it has cream. And that's kind of a contention, especially once the French, they got their grubby little hands on it. They started adding cream to it because, you know, the French put cream in everything. Which isn't to say that's a bad thing, all right? I mean, I have it on good authority that Thomas Keller finishes his risotto with whipped cream at the French Laundry. So who am I to question Thomas Keller? But I'm just talking about tradition here. But before I even get into the whole cream thing and how to finish a risotto, let's actually talk about what risotto is. And so it is a creamy rice dish that is slowly cooked. And it usually uses arborio rice. Now, there are other short, fat grains of rice out there that are sometimes used in Italy. I mean, it's a little bit harder to find outside of Italy. If you're going to be making risotto in anywhere outside of Italy, chances are the rice that you're going to use is arborio rice. Now, it is important that you get the specific arborio or another form of short grain, fat, stubby risotto rice. You cannot just use any rice to make risotto. Now, the reason why is because these short, fat little rice grains contain a lot of starch. And it's that starch is very, very important to the finished texture because during the cooking process of the rice or the risotto, when you're going through the risotto making process, you're slowly cooking it and coaxing out those starches, which is going to give you that nice, beautiful creaminess to your dish. Now, to start the risotto making process, you're going to, first of all, you want to, let's look at the liquid to rice ratio. Okay, usually you're doing 2-to-1 with normal rice. With risotto, you want to up that ratio anywhere from 3-to-1 to 4-to-1. And it's really hard to say, you know, only because you got to bring that stock to a simmer and have it hot while you're making your risotto. So maybe it may reduce a little bit faster than someone else's stock. So there are some variables. Okay, so to play it safe, I probably, even though you're going to use on average about a 3-to-1 ratio, sometimes it's safe to start with a 4-to-1 ratio, even a 5-to-1 ratio of a stock or water. So regardless of what you're going to use, whether it's stock or water, you want to bring that to a nice little simmer in a separate pot and have it off to the side, okay? And you want to get a heavy bottom saucepan with a straight up and down edges, and you're going to melt in some butter. Now, the amount of butter that I use to actually start the risotto making process or sweat down my risotto, it's a personal preference. I use anywhere from a 1-to-6 ratio to a 1-to-8 ratio. So basically, for every 6 ounces of arborio rice that I'm going to be cooking, I'm going to be using 1 ounce of butter. And if it looks too dry, you know, add more butter. More butter. You know, you don't want it actually, you know, totally greasy. But you're going to get your butter melting slowly over low, medium-low heat. And you're going to throw in some minced shallots. How much minced shallots? I don't know. I don't care. You're just throwing some minced shallots. You know what I mean? If you're a shallot kind of guy like me, you know, you throw in a good handful. If you just want a little back hint of shallots, you know, throw in maybe half a shallot to 2 shallots if you're going to be making, say, 3 orders of a risotto. But the key is you want to start sweating down those shallots in the butter. And the sweating process is nothing more than cooking over low heat and not browning. And the whole purpose of this process is to sort of coax the flavor out of the shallots and to soften them slightly. You don't want to brown them. But pretty much you're just going to sweat the shallots for about 5 to 10 minutes until they become soft and translucent and they give out that nice, you know, shallot smell. You can start, you know, having that aroma fill your kitchen. At this point, you're going to throw in your dry arborio rice. And this is an important step because you don't want your rice to be sticky or stick together. So you're going to throw it directly into your sweated shallots and your melted butter, and you're going to toss it around. And you want that fat to evenly coat each grain of rice or each grain of that arborio, and that's going to keep it from sticking together. Now, if it looks too dry, if it doesn't look evenly coated, you can add more fat. And just a little side note, the fat, mind you, does not have to be butter. You know, I like butter. I mean, who doesn't like butter? But if you're, say, preparing it for a vegan, you can use olive oil or canola oil. Now, olive oil does have a distinct flavor, so that will be adding a certain flavor to your risotto. Just be mindful of that. Or you can use something like duck fat. You know, give it more of a gamey sort of ducky taste, especially if you're going to be serving it alongside a duck. That might be a nice touch. So once your risotto is nice and evenly coated, you're going to add in your first ladle of stock. And you don't want to add in that much. You want to add in just enough to sort of just barely slightly cover the kernels of risotto. So if you're making this at home, you're probably going to add in about 4 ounces of stock at a time. And you're going to stir with a wooden spoon or wooden spatula. You're going to constantly, constantly stir that rice and that stock together. And you want your pan on a nice low simmer. See, the trick is the reason why you have your stock or your water nice and hot during the risotto making process is because you always want your rice at a constant low simmer. You don't want to have it ever really drop below a simmer or raise to a boil. So you're adding in that hot stock and you want to adjust your flame on your risotto pan down to a low or medium low, whatever's going to help maintain that nice low and slow percolating simmer. Now, once that stock is almost completely evaporated out, you're going to add in another ladle, and you're going to continue this process for about 18 to 20 minutes while you're cooking. Now, that's just a guideline to kind of give you an idea. But really, you need to get into the feel and the essence and kind of, you know, become one with the risotto, Danielson. And know the visual cues and the flavor cues for when it's done. So you don't want your risotto to turn into mush or to porridge, right? But you also don't want it to be crunchy. So you want it to have a nice firm texture, but at the same time, you don't want it to, you know, taste like you're eating sand or granules. So a good telltale sign on this is when you bite into a kernel of risotto, and you can start checking this about, you know, 15 minutes out or 15 minutes during the cooking process. When you bite down, it should be nice and tender, but still have a little bit of firmness to it, but it should never stick to your teeth. And that's the dead giveaway of undercooked risotto. If the risotto kernels stick to your teeth, then you need to continue cooking. You're not done yet. Now, once you've reached that proper texture to where you want it to be, now it's time to finish the risotto. Now, a good place to start would be a little bit of salt, okay, but also a little bit of acid too. You know, you want to add in, say, some lemon juice, maybe some white wine, maybe a little splash of champagne vinegar because of the richness of the risotto. Now, also, you want to finish with butter, and that butter is going to sort of slack out the risotto, loosen it up a little bit, but give it, you know, it's going to melt in and emulsify and become a nice creamy texture. And usually when you add in the butter, you're going to turn off the flame and use the residual heat from that's contained within the risotto itself to melt down that butter and just disperse it evenly, because you don't want that butter to break, because if the butter breaks out, then it's going to make your risotto look nice and, not so nice. Actually, it's going to look, fatty and greasy, which is not what you're going for. Now, like I alluded to before, some people will actually opt to finish with cream. And look, I'm not here to point fingers or to, yell or scream or rant and rave. Okay, well, maybe I am. But I'm going to try and be nice about this, because food is all about, you have to understand the technique behind it and then make your own decisions. So if you want to break a food rule, no problem. Go about it, but just understand why you're breaking it. So my contention is, if you're adding cream to your risotto for the creaminess aspect, then you're completely missing the whole picture, right? Because the whole beauty of risotto is you're coaxing the starch out of those kernels during that slow cooking process, and you're making it nice and creamy. So if you're reducing cream into your risotto at the end to achieve that creamy texture, then I disagree with that. Now, if you're adding a little splash of cream into your risotto for a nice mouthfeel or to add a little bit more fat because, fat tastes good, then I'm okay with that. That's not how I make my risotto personally. I just finish with a big old pat of butter and, I swirl that in and then I call it good. But, if you feel it's necessary to add some cream, by all means, but just understand why you're adding it in the first place. You don't want to be serving, arborio rice with cream sauce. You want to be serving risotto. There definitely is a difference. Now, also, too, unfortunately, see, I'm all for taking shortcuts in the kitchen up until the point of it affecting, the end product of my food, right? Especially when you work in a professional kitchen, you're always short on time. And the more efficient you can work and the faster you can get things done, the more time you have to take on better projects and to push your food forward. That's always been my philosophy. But I have never found a technique where risotto can be left on the stove or cooked unattended in a fast manner where it actually comes out as good as a nice risotto that's prepared with love and painstakingly stirring and the whole thing constantly, right? I've seen people write articles about how to make risotto in your microwave, how to make it in a slow cooker, how to make it in a crock pot. I disagree completely with all of it. So that's just my own personal opinion. Again, if you follow a recipe for risotto in the microwave and you love it, that's fine. But I would encourage you to first try this method that we talked about, the traditional technique of, you know, slowly simmering and slowly stirring your risotto and cooking with love, and then compare the two. Now, one last thing. The texture of your risotto, when you actually go to put it on your plate, when you plate it up, it should be nice and creamy, but it shouldn't be runny. It shouldn't like sputter out and like pool out on the plate, right? But in the same respect, it should not be stiff. And there's this travesty going on where people think it's cool to pack risotto into ring molds, you know, because it gives them a tight look or whatever. And it's just so sad. If your risotto was tight enough to pack into a ring mold or to squeeze into form, then it's way too dry, and it's not risotto. Risotto is a sexy, creamy, starchy rice dish that's just absolutely amazing when done properly. So can we just, as a whole, can we just not pack risotto in ring molds anymore, please? Please? Okay. Now, one last little tip before we move on is you can't actually par cook your risotto, right? So if you're going to throw a dinner party, and this is how all restaurants do it, because, you know, cooking, when you get an order of risotto, right, cooking it from start to finish, which is going to take you about 25 minutes. And that's not really how, you know, you're going to have some pretty angry customers on your hands if you're taking 25 minutes just to do a single order of risotto. So the way that it's done in a restaurant is we'll go through the normal risotto making process, and then we'll get it, you know, about where we've been cooking the rice for, say, you know, 10 minutes, right? You know, with the liquid nice and slow. And you get it to that point when you bite down on a risotto kernel, it's starting to give slightly, but it's still kind of sort of sticking to your teeth, right? So it's a little undercooked. At that point, you want to take it out and you want to spread it nice and thin on a sheet tray and then refrigerate it and cool it down. So next time when you're ready to serve your risotto, when your guests arrive or when you get an order for it in the restaurant, then that's when you get another pan going. And this is your opportunity to reinforce some flavors. So your risotto was just a regular, you know, plain flavored risotto to begin with. But for example, say you want to do like a mushroom or like a mushroom veal risotto, right? So what you would do is you get out your saute pan, you hit it with a little butter, a little bit of olive oil, or some canola oil, and you would, you know, saute down some nice mushrooms in that, right? Deglaze with a little bit of red wine, and then you want to add in your ladle of stock first. In this case, you'd be using veal stock, but it could be, you know, any sort of stock or hot water. And you want to add that in first and bring it to a simmer, and then you want to gently add in the amount of risotto that you're looking to cook, right? And for this process, I actually like to use a slotted kitchen spoon, because I'll take my little pat of risotto, it'll cake together after it cools down, and I gently put it into the pan, and I'll use the back of the slotted spoon to press it down into my pan, into my slowly simmering broth, to break up into individual kernels. And from there, you're going to cook it as normal, right? You're going to reduce down the broth. If you need to add in a little bit more stock, add in a little more stock. And you're going to finish with butter, season it with salt and some, you know, champagne vinegar or lemon juice or whatever you desire. And that's how you're going to bring back that risotto all au minute without having to cook it start to finish. So this way you can actually, you know, entertain your guests and interact with them instead of, you know, slaving over a risotto pot, which is a lot of times at a dinner party is just your side dish anyways. Now, the next starch I want to talk about is polenta, which, oddly enough, again, is an Italian starch, and it comes from it's basically a staple of northern Italy, but it's there's lots of different forms of polenta used throughout the world, and including in the United States in the South, we have something called grits, which is very, very similar to the polenta, right? Because polenta is basically coarsely ground yellow cornmeal, whereas grits classically are made from hominy, which is dried yellow or white corn kernels, which the hull and germ have been removed, and then they grind it either coarse, medium, or fine, And that's grits. And they cook it very much similar to how we would cook polenta. And it's, you know, in the South, it's very commonly served as a breakfast side. You know, as instead of potatoes, they serve grits, which is actually very, very tasty. So the reason why I like polenta is, again, because it's a versatile canvas, right? You can do so many different things with it once you understand the base recipe. So let's talk about the base recipe. It's just polenta, right? You're going to go out, you're going to get, you know, you want to get the dried polenta. Sometimes they have like, no, so never get instant polenta, okay? Bad, 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 you know, shame on you if you use instant polenta. And also, you'll see like these tubes of, it's like, I guess it's like pre-cooked soft polenta. It almost looks like a Jimmy Dean sausage tube, but it actually has like par-cooked polenta in it. Now, I've never used those, but they, I have seen them at the supermarket, and my only impression on them, since I haven't used it, is that they are rather expensive. If you buy, you know, a 5-pound, 10-pound bulk bag of polenta, it'll last you a while, and it's dried, so it's not going to go bad, and it's much more economical. So your standard ratio for polenta is going to be a 4-to-1 ratio, 4 parts liquid to 1 part polenta. And again, you can use, you know, water, chicken stock, veal stock, whatever you want to do to flavor it, just like you would the risotto. And again, with both the risotto and the polenta, you want to make sure, especially if you're going to be serving it as a side dish, that your stock choice or your liquid choice during the cooking process is appropriate to complement your main entree, right? Or your main protein. So, for example, if you're going to say, if you're going to be serving your risotto or your polenta alongside a beef tenderloin or filet mignon, it probably won't be appropriate to cook your polenta with, say, a lobster stock, right? It just wouldn't really make sense. Now, when I make my polenta, I like to use chicken base, which is, you know, just the, you know, the, like you get at the store, right? The chicken base, and I always use Miners, M-I-N-O-R-S, Miners chicken base, and no, they are not an advertiser, but that's just what I use in the professional kitchen. The reason why I actually opt for chicken base over chicken stock is because, you know, chicken base has a nice saltiness to it, and it is appropriate to use chicken base in certain applications, and I feel that this is one of the applications where it's appropriate. Because it will give some of that chicken flavor, and it will give a nice little meaty saltiness to your polenta. But also, too, it has this nice golden color, whereas a roasted chicken stock is more of a brownish color. And when it mixed with the golden polenta, it kind of dulls out that nice bright color of the you know, of the gold from the polenta. So I found that using a chicken base when making my polenta, just in general, it yields a better color, and I really enjoy the flavor as well. So, you know, just follow the directions on the back of the container, whatever brand you buy. And so if you have, you know, say a cup of polenta that you're going to make, a cup of dry polenta, you're going to get 4 cups of water or stock boiling. And once it comes to a boil, all you're simply going to do is just slowly stream in that polenta, while in the other hand, you're just whisking the liquid. And this is going to, you know, the slow stream of the polenta falling into liquid while you're whisking it is just going to keep it from clumping together, because you really want it to be nice and smooth and creamy. You don't want your polenta to clump. And if it clumps at the beginning of the cooking process, you got to kind of start over. You're kind of screwed. So once you get all the polenta into the water and incorporated, you want to keep on whisking it until it comes back up to a simmer. Now, once it comes to a simmer, you want to drop it, the temperature or the flame, down to low, medium, low. You really want it as low as possible, because you want just barely a percolation. Now, your Italian grandmother would tell you to, you know, stand over that pot and stir and stir and stir for the next 20 minutes, which if my grandma was standing next to me, and if she was Italian, I would do without argument. Okay, it's not ever a smart idea to argue with your Italian grandmother. However, I've found that when she is not in the room, you can actually, for the first couple of minutes, you want to stir that polenta on a nice low simmer. And once you're kind of assured that it's coming together nicely and there's no major clumps, again, you're going to reduce that flame to really as low as it can go. And you're going to cover the pot with tin foil or you know, a lid, whatever you have around. And then set your timer for 20 minutes. That's it. When you come back, you're going to notice that the polenta has kind of sunk to the bottom a little bit, and there's a little bit like a layer of stock on top of the polenta, which you can easily just stir back together, and the polenta will be finished cooking. Now, at this point, you're going to finish it much like you would your risotto. You know, you can add in, you know, mascarpone cheese is very commonly added to polenta. You can actually, it is okay to add in a little bit of cream, in my opinion. All right. But then again, there's the whole cream debate on that as well, which we're not going to get into. And then, but my favorite thing, again, to finish polenta is with lots and lots of butter. You know, just keep on putting that butter, more better, until it's, you know, a nice buttery, tasty polenta. And again, you want to make sure you check for seasoning. If you're using the chicken-based method, you will have, you know, some salt from that. So, you know, taste your polenta before you finish with any salt. And, you know, go wild with it. You know, there's all sorts of herbs and spices and flavors you can throw in there. It's really hard to mess polenta up with an herb. You know, I mean, so you can throw in some basil or some marjoram, a little bit of rosemary. Rosemary is a pretty strong herb, as you know. Also, too, you know, finishing with like a goat cheese or a pecorino, you know, as it's not really super classic, but it is tasty. And there's no rules on this. Again, the reason, like I stated before, the reason why I really like polenta and risotto and even mashed potatoes is it really is sort of a blank canvas that once you can prepare the canvas properly, you can easily add any other number of supporting flavors to really take it to the next level. So let's talk about mashed potatoes real quick, which is really, you know, I mean, the last two starches were staples of, you know, Italy, right? Now, I'm not saying the United States that we invented mashed potatoes, but we dang well, I mean, they're ours, okay? I mean, just like we didn't necessarily invent pizza or hamburgers or the French fry, okay? Mashed potatoes is pretty much as American as you can get, okay? There's so many different techniques and recipes, and like you got to do this and you got to do that, and don't do this and don't do that. And a lot of culinary dogma associated with it, with making mashed potatoes. And there's always inevitably that argument around Thanksgiving and Christmas time as to how you make the mashed potatoes and how you make the giblet gravy and this and that and the other. So let's talk about sort of the professional method of making mashed potatoes, because everyone knows the basic straightforward method, I'm assuming, which is you basically you peel your potatoes, you boil them. Once they become tender, you drain off the liquid, you mash them, and you add in your butter and your cream, and you mash them with your little hand masher, and you add your salt, and that's mashed potatoes, right? And that's normally what you will find in some variation or another on a holiday table. So for me, when I do mashed potatoes, especially in the restaurant, I like to refine them a little bit more, you know, because, I don't like to make my food over foofy, right, if that's even a word, or over pretentious, I guess would be more appropriate, without really, you know, just for the sake of making it like hoity-toity, right? But also, too, you shouldn't be I feel guilty as a chef if I make it too homey as well. If it's something that you could easily make at your house, then, you know, why would you want to come into my restaurant in the first place? So there are a little extra steps that I do add into the process that are, you know, somewhat time-consuming, especially if you're not used to doing them. And they do yield a much better product, in my opinion. Now, the first step is, well, number one, let's talk about the potato. You know, you can use either russet potatoes or Yukon Golds. Now, a lot of professional chefs, they prefer the Yukon Golds. They have a nice golden color when you peel them and you boil them. Also, they're a little bit less starchy than the russet potatoes. But I found that russet potatoes work great as well, especially if you use lots and lots of butter, which, you know, why wouldn't you? So, in general, when I make my mashed potatoes, I actually do use Yukon Golds. But again, russets are fine. And you want to start by peeling them. Right now, if you're into having like that kind of country mash with the skin on, I would actually recommend doing like baby new potatoes, right, or the baby red potatoes, and you can mash those up with the skin. The skin's gonna be more tender than the ones, especially found on russet potatoes. So it's gonna have a better texture. It's not gonna be as gritty as you will with the russet. So with russet or a large Yukon Gold, you want to start by peeling them, and then cutting them into, say, you know, 2-inch chunks. Right, for the boiling process. Now, the first step that's commonly missed in the home kitchen is you want to rinse them. And so I'll put my cut and peeled potatoes into the same pot that I'm going to boil them in, and I'm going to run them under cold water. I'm going to stick my hand in there, and I'm going to really kind of agitate them and, you know, move those potatoes around. and they'll release their starches, and you'll see that the water gets really cloudy. You want to dump that off and do this a couple more times, and then you can, you know, go, you know, away somewhere else and prep something for the next 5 or 10 minutes while you're just kind of letting that cold water run through your potatoes. When you come back, your water should be much clearer. Now, this is going to get rid of your excess starch, which later in the cooking process and also when you're actually, you know, mashing the potatoes during the mashing process specifically, that excess starch can kind of form a matrix and become gummy. And that's when you get those overworked, gluey mashed potatoes that, you know, stick to the top of your mouth and kind of funky. So that's secret number one, is you want to rinse your potatoes. Secret number two is you always want to start your potatoes in cold, salted water. And we went over this whole process and why you would do this in our blanching episode, right? But basically, just to recap, it's going to cook it more evenly. It's going to cook the potato starches a lot more evenly, starting it in cold water. And the salt is there just as a seasoning. Because once you actually cook the potatoes in the boiling water, they're going to, you know, become sort of somewhat waterlogged. And they're not going to be able to take up a whole lot more seasoning. So you want to, you know, start off by, you know, seasoning your potatoes in that step during the boiling process. Now, what you're looking for is you're going to do a nice slow simmer. You don't want to really harshly boil the potatoes because they will start to kind of flake and fall apart, which is not what you're looking for. You still want those chunks of potato to remain whole. So you're going to boil them or, you know, do a nice gentle simmer. And for how long? I don't know. It depends on how dense your potatoes are, how many you're cooking, you know, any number of things. You just want to go till they're slightly more than fork tender. Okay, there's fork tender where your fork can go into the potato easily and come out. I like to take it just a hair past that to where it almost looks like the outer edges of the potatoes are going to start to crumble. And this is going to make it a lot easier to you know, incorporate your other ingredients further on down the line without having to overwork them. Now, once my potatoes have reached that phase where they're just beyond fork tender, it's time to drain them. You're just going to drain them in a simple colander, okay, and just kind of let them sit in the colander, give them a couple of shakes. You just want to shake off that excess water and excess moisture. Now, a lot of people, they really, like they'll say, oh, you got to throw it back in the pot, and then it's on the pot for a while, like on the stove, because you don't want any water in there. Really, it's not a big deal. As long as you strain them properly, those potatoes are nice and hot, and that starchy water that you boiled the potatoes in, if you got it, you know, a couple of ounces dispersed throughout your potatoes, it's actually going to help emulsify in your cream and butter, which at this point should be melting on your stove because you want to make sure you're adding a hot cream and butter to your mashed potatoes. Not only because it's, you know, cold cream and butter might cool off your mashed potatoes too much when you go to serve, and they're going to be, you know, lukewarm instead of nice and hot. But also, too, I like to add lots and lots of butter to my mashed potatoes. Surprise, surprise. So if you add cold butter to your hot mashed potatoes, it will be easier for your butter to break and make your mashed potatoes look greasy and kind of gross. And also, because you're using cold butter, you're not going to be able to emulsify in as much as you would if you're using warm butter. So the question begs to ask, how much butter? Well, a lot of butter. A lot of butter. Okay, you don't want to know how much butter because that is a lot. The number one problem with mashed potatoes that are made at home is, number one, they never contain enough butter because people are too health conscious. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I just mean, look, it's Thanksgiving, it's Christmas. That's why you're making mashed potatoes. You should never be making mashed potatoes as part of a healthy family dinner, right? So if you're going to make mashed potatoes, go for it. You know, add your butter. And they're also very commonly under-seasoned. You'd be surprised how much salt mashed potatoes can take before they become over salty. And so those are the two things that, you know, as our culture becomes more and more healthy, people, they're a little bit more shy about adding into their mashed potatoes. So you got to add a lot of butter. And I usually do for every, say for every, you know, let's look at it this way. For every large russet or Yukon Gold potato, I'm adding 2 to 3 ounces of butter, all right? So that's just how I do it. And then in the same ratio, I'm going to be adding, you know, 1 ounce of cream for every, you know, large potato that I'm going to use, right? And you always want to make sure you have excess butter around because if your potatoes aren't buttery enough, you want to add it. So the way that I use my cream, too, is a lot of people do half butter, half cream. I prefer my potatoes to be more buttery, right, than creamy. Because the if you do it properly, if you if you mash your potatoes properly, they'll always be creamy as far as texturally based. Whereas the actual heavy cream itself will mute those flavors. So you want to add your cream and your butter into a pot. You want to slowly melt them together, and you make sure you keep an eye on that pot because it can easily boil over. Now, once you've strained your potatoes and you have your cream nice and hot, it's time to mash them. But instead of using a hand masher or beating them up in your KitchenAid or your food processor, really the best way, in my opinion, to do it to get that nice, smooth, creamy texture is to use a food mill, also commonly referred to as a potato ricer. And basically, a food mill looks almost like a conical colander with a grid on the end, or basically holes that they call a die, and you can switch these dies from a medium, a large, or a small, and you have a hand crank that forces your cooked food through this die. And normally for my mashed potatoes, I'm using either a large or a medium die. And so what happens is by putting your mashed potatoes, putting those cooked potatoes through a food mill first, it's going to smash them into small, even, almost like a puree, but it's not quite a puree yet because you haven't added your fat. So after you pass your potatoes through a food mill, then all you have to simply do is, whether they're in a back in a pot or in a bowl, is you're going to add your hot melted butter and cream mixture, and you're going to either whisk it in with a hand whisk or you're going to stir it in with a spoon. Now, also, because you first pass your potatoes through a ricer, they're going to have more surface area. They're already going to be nice and smooth, and they're going to suck up that cream and butter a lot more readily. And that's going to allow you to do a very minimal amount of mixing, because if you overmix your mashed potatoes during the phase where you add in your cream and butter, that's how you get the overworked mashed potatoes that turn to glue and to gum, right? So it does actually double duty when you pass your potatoes through a mill. Number one, it's going to give you a finer texture, but number two, it's going to keep them from getting gluey, okay? At that point, once you've incorporated so much butter and cream into your mashed potatoes to where it's almost like, no, I can't take any more, that's when it's time to look at your final seasoning. And so at that point, that's when I usually add kosher salt or sea salt. But also, too, you can add pepper, you can add roasted bacon, caramelized onions, caramelized garlic, roasted garlic, blanched garlic, whatever you want for that finished dish. Now, one small contention that I do have is that sometimes people will add white pepper to their mashed potatoes, which in itself isn't really a culinary crime. But when you ask them, why do you use white pepper instead of black pepper, their answer is, well, because, I don't want black pepper flakes in my white mashed potatoes. It doesn't look good, so I add white pepper. And wrong. That is not the correct answer. White pepper has its own distinct flavor that's completely different from black pepper. Now, if you like that sort of funky barnyard flavor, which does have its place in certain applications in your mashed potatoes, by all means, use it. But don't use white pepper just for the visual sake, right? Because it will add a certain flavor to your mashed potatoes. Also, another thing that you need to grasp is salt and pepper aren't like this magical combination that you can't have one without the other, right? They are exclusive from one another, and they are actually different. Salt is a seasoning. Pepper is a flavoring. Now, that's a very important concept to understand, because a lot of the times, even in professional kitchens, you hear salt and pepper, salt and pepper, salt and pepper, salt and pepper. But again, salt is a seasoning. Pepper is a flavoring. So you don't have to put pepper on everything. And in a lot of instances, when you're serving like a nice delicate fish or a nice delicate white wine, or even like a very long aged red wine, pepper can interfere with that flavor. So you want to make sure that you're adding pepper consciously to whatever you're cooking, and you're adding it because you desire that pepper flavor. Now, again, this whole technique discussion was more to talk about the process and the underlying philosophies behind how you make these certain starches. But if you want more in-depth information, such as technique videos and all of our recipes, especially with the recipes with all the different variations on it, head on over to stellaculinary.com and check out the episode 5 show notes, and I'll have all that info for you there, as well as a quiz for this episode and also your homework assignment, which obviously is to make one of these three starches. using the recipes provided and the techniques that you have learned in this episode, and then get back to me on how it turned out. All right, so in today's announcements, we're just got a couple of quick things. Actually, just really one thing I wanted to give a shout-out to, a website called Style Me Pretty. And actually, it's a pretty big name wedding blog, which is kind of cool. And they did a nice little review, or not necessarily a review, a write-up of one of the weddings that we did at the Cedar House last fall. And it was a lot of fun to very cool concept. We did a five-course beer pairing dinner for them. And a really fun couple, lots of fun, nice local couple. And anyways, the photographer took some beautiful photos of the area, and it was pretty artistic stuff. But if you're interested in kind of seeing what it's like to do a wedding firsthand at the Cedar House, head on over to Style. Actually, it's stylemepretty.com is a good place to get information, but for the actual post where it talks about us, go ahead and head on over to stellaculinary.com for the episode 5 show notes, and I'll make sure that I put a link there to that so you can check out that article. I always thought that was pretty cool. So thanks again to Style Me Pretty. And if you're planning on having a wedding in the Tahoe area, or if now, because of you hearing this, you want to have a wedding in the Tahoe area, go ahead and give us a call at the Cedar House, or shoot us an email. And all of our wedding consultations are free, so, I mean, we're not going to charge you to come up and check out the facility and for us to put together a package for you. And we pretty much, we customize in doing things very unique for each different client and, you know, having a lot of fun with doing a lot of different cool wedding packages with food themes and decorations and all sorts of craziness that goes down when we have weddings. Because basically you come in and you take over our entire property and it's like it's yours for the weekend. So anyways, if you're interested in doing that, you contact me or contact Patty over at the Cedar House, and we'll put together a nice little package for you to review for all your wedding needs. So for today's culinary quick tip, I'm going to give you a tip on kind of the process that I use to make my palms puree. And you know how we're talking about like a, you know, more butter, more butter? Well, palms puree is basically mashed potatoes that are, you know, milled and nice and smooth that just have an insane amount of butter in it. Now, the secret to a good palms puree has always been, you know, adding enough butter to the point where it almost would break on you, but not quite that far. Because again, once your butter starts to break on you and break out of your mashed potatoes, then, you know, just you have greasy looking potatoes and it looks horrible and it's very unappetizing. So what I do is I use a emulsifying agent called xanthan gum. And I love xanthan gum. It's a great thickener. It's a great emulsifier. And what xanthan gum will allow you to do is not only, you know, help keep your potatoes from breaking to where you can add such an insane amount of butter to your mashed potatoes that you can turn into like a butter and potato soup. But also, too, it's going to give you the ability to pre-emulsify your butter into another flavoring agent. So, for example, if I want to do a, say, caramelized fennel palms puree, I'm going to take my fennel, slice it up, get it all nice and caramelized. And then I would need a little bit of water to blend it in the blender, right? So that can be like a warm stock or broth or just warm water, okay? So I would take the caramelized fennel, the warm water, I'd put it in a blender, and just enough water to, you know, make a nice smooth puree. And I'm going to add just a little touch of xanthan gum, probably no more than 0.25% by weight. But what this really means to you is you can eyeball it with just like the tip of a spoon, all right? You want just the tip of a spoon. You want to drop that xanthan gum in there. And then from that point, you can start adding in cubed butter. And you want to just keep on adding it into the blender and working that blender speed up. And your butter, you'll see your butter emulsify into this mixture. It'll become nice and smooth. And you're going to keep on adding butter until the vortex that is formed by the movement of that blender blade, it's going to form like that hole right in the center, which we call a vortex. And it's going to become smaller and smaller and smaller as the emulsion thickens with the addition of the butter. And once that emulsion, or the vortex hole gets to, say, the size of a nickel, you're going to want to turn it off and your emulsion is going to be nice and thick. From here, you just do the exact same process where first you mill your potatoes like we talked about before. And then when you add your butter, you can actually incorporate your butter by putting your milled potatoes into a Roboco or a food processor. And you want to stream in your butter emulsion into the potatoes while that blade's working. And again, you want to do this quickly because you don't want to overwork your potatoes and make them gluey. Now, once you add in just an amazing amount of butter, because you want this, you know, you want to really actually palms puree. You want it to actually be a puree. You want it to be nice and thin on the plate. You don't want it to be like, it shouldn't be able to stand up in a large pile. So once you have all that butter incorporated to where it's a nice puree consistency, you then, an optional step, it's going to be pretty smooth as is, but one last optional step is to take it and then pass it through a tamis and or a tammy, right? You can call it a tamis or a tammy, whatever. And it's basically a screen that's pulled tight over a drum that you pass your puree through, and it's going to ensure a nice, even, smooth texture. Now, from here, one of the greatest components, because it's not that hard to make a nice palms puree if you're going to serve it immediately, right? But say you're doing like a palms puree for a banquet or for a party, all right? And you want to do it an hour ahead or 2 hours ahead. So you would have to then hold it on a steam table where you're basically doing a double boiler. So holding it like holding a traditional palms puree on a steam table, keeping it nice and warm for an extended period of time, more often than not, your butter is going to break out. Well, using the xanthan gum as an emulsifying agent, it's going to make it a lot harder for that holding your palms puree over heat for that emulsion to break. And the great thing is, a lot of the times, if it does break, which is very rare, you can usually just bring that emulsion back together by stirring it vigorously with a whisk or a wooden spoon. Now, xanthan gum is actually, you can find it a lot of times at a health food store because it's used as a component in gluten-free flour. It's actually used as a binding agent, which will allow the flour to trap gases when it's made into a dough, since normally that's the job of the gluten. So if you have a well-stocked local health food store or all-natural food store, they should carry xanthan gum. Now, if not, you can actually order it online, and there are a couple different people that I use to get my xanthan gum through online. So if you are looking for xanthan gum, you want to play around with it, it really is my all-purpose go-to sort of little secret technique, both for adding a little bit of viscosity to a sauce, but I really use it a lot for stabilized emulsions, because you use it in such small amounts and it has no flavor. It's not really going to impart a flavor onto your sauce. It really is a really nice tool to have at your disposal in your kitchen. So if you're interested in playing around with it a little bit, head on over to stellaculinary.com and the episode 5 show notes, and I'll have a link to how to get some xanthan gum there. And that's it for this episode of the Stella Culinary School Podcast. Thank you once again for joining me. Hey, if you haven't already, sign up for our seasonal email newsletter with Roger's Wine Corner and some nice little techniques and tricks on how you can best use the produce that is coming into season. Also, Twitter me at Chef Jacob. Check out our Stella Culinary Facebook fan page for all those cool photos. And until next time, this is Jacob with the Stella Culinary School Podcast, reminding you to cook with passion.